Everything happens for a reason. There's no such thing as coincidence. You've probably heard that phrase. You might have even said it. But have you ever thought about, like, really? Does everything happen for a reason? Is there no such thing as coincidence? I mean, really, I had a turkey sandwich. Was I supposed to have a tuna sandwich? What does it mean? When I first moved to New York City, I don't know if you had this experience, but I thought it was amazing when I would bump into somebody that I knew downtown. Like, I was like, what are the odds? You know, there's 8 million people that live in New York, and I just bumped into someone I knew, and it's kind of happened a lot more often, and now I'm like, I don't know if there's a reason, it's just kind of awesome. Everything happens for a reason. There's no such thing as a coincidence. Now, if you're not a Christian person, if you're not a God follower, then this isn't really a big deal. You can just say, no, it's all coincidence, who cares? Or it's just the universe, or it's Buddha, or karma, or whatever, it doesn't matter. But if you're a Christian, it becomes a little bit problematic, you know, because we believe in this God that created everything, and we believe has a plan for humanity, and he's somehow orchestrating things, and how much does he orchestrate things? Now, I don't want to talk about Calvinism, where God orchestrates every single thing, and Arminianism, where God orchestrates some things. I don't want to talk about that. Don't want to get into that discussion. I'm probably not the best person to have it with. But what I do want to talk about is how it affects us, how we think about what is God doing in my life, and how do I react to the coincidences or the circumstances of my life. How are we supposed to make decisions in light of the fact that God could be doing something? Does that make sense? So the reason that this is important, the reason that I'm even talking about this, is because I think that we kind of live in a tension, and we really live on either extreme. On the one hand, we could look at our situation and say, like we're really slow to find God's involvement in anything. So if you're not a Christian, if you're not a God believer, this might be your modus operandi, but even if you are a believer, we can be kind of slow to see God's work. We're just kind of focused on our lives, doing our own thing, wanting to have a good life, wanting to feel good about our lives. We're not really looking for God, so we're not going to find him doing anything special in our lives. We're just living our lives, okay? On the other side, we can be too quick to find God's involvement in our lives, right? This is like you just believe that every moment of your life is like divinely orchestrated by God, and this can really lead to some stress, right? Like, what if I was supposed to get the turkey sandwich instead of the tuna sandwich? Am I not following God's will? What am I supposed to do? And it just is stressful, and I wouldn't want to live that way. I don't think you would either. It's really motivated out of fear that I can't figure out what God has for me. I've got to figure it out. I've got to do the right thing. That's all fear and guilt. But somehow we've got to find where we're supposed to be. And I'm not really a fan of either of those extremes, to where we just live our life and don't worry about it, or that we stress and worry about everything. Really, both of them are really self-centered. Of course, you're thinking about your own life and your own happiness. But even over here, you want to make sure that you're good with God. You want to make sure that you're following God. And, you know, I've even experienced this myself and with others, but you get into a place where you feel like God might be calling you to do something, but you're so worried about if it's right or wrong that you don't end up doing anything. You're petrified by what the possibilities might be. For example, this is back in college, quite a while ago. This is kind of a goofy example from my own life, but very real. And I share this story with you because it's always easier to look back in the history and see like how things stacked up to see how they came about today than when you're in it, you're looking at your circumstances, trying to make decisions, and you just don't know how things are going to work out. So looking back in my life, back when I was in college, I, of course, wanted to find a spouse, wanted to marry a Christian woman, and I'm pretty sure that's God's will. You know, that's what he would want for me, okay? But I had it in my mind, I did not think about this at the time, but I just had it in my mind that God had to make it happen. So I didn't date anybody for like a period of my life. And you're thinking like, Nathan, that's stupid. Like, you can't just expect God, poof, here's the perfect woman in front of you, ready, marry her. Like, you've got to do something. You got to put yourself out there. You got to date somebody. But gosh, when we're in the middle of it, we just don't think that way. It's hard to have good thinking about what decisions we make in our lives. Well, today we're going to look at the book of Esther. And I'm so excited about Esther. It's one of my favorite books in the Bible. But what we see in the story of Esther is God using circumstances, or seeming circumstances, to bring about his will in Esther's life. And we learn a really important principle that will help us make decisions for the future. Okay, so like I said, Esther is my favorite book of the Bible. It's my favorite story in the Bible. It's such a great story. Any scholar, whether they're a Christian or a non-Christian, they agree that this is a masterpiece. This was written in the 4th or 5th century BC. It's so well written. It's one of those stories that makes you love to love the protagonist, right? And you love to hate the antagonist. And there's twists and turns, and they're in a palace, and there's kings and queens and stuff. And this is real exciting if you're like a language person or a literary person. The entire story is chiastic. Yeah, there's like two people maybe that know what that means. It's chiastic, which means that everything that happens in the beginning has a mirrored event in the ending. So awesome. The book Beowulf, the ancient, the old English story, Beowulf, you might have read in English class, that was a chiasm. And you might know this quick phrase, it's chiastic. Ask not what your country can do for you. So take those same words, flip them around. Ask what you can do for your country. It's chiasm. And in the story of Esther, there are six moves, and then everything hinges on the seventh move, this fulcrum. And then we see a mirror image of everything that happened at the beginning and that it ends. Oh, it's so great. This is really important for having the story around because it's easy to memorize it and retell it. You know, in ancient times when you didn't have a written copy of everything. But regardless of that, you don't have to care about that at all. I just think it's fun and exciting. If you're looking for an application to the sermon already, here it is. Go home. Read the book of Esther. It's so good. It'll take you 20 to 30 minutes. Such a great read. It's a really fun story. A word of caution, though. When you read Esther, you may be tempted to think that it's a fairy tale or a children's story because there are kings and queens, and there is a palace and royal balls and parties and all that kind of stuff, but there's no witches, there's no warlocks, there's no magic, there's no dragons, none of that. This is written as if it were historical fact, which I believe it is. And it's just about real people facing extraordinary circumstances. One other thing before we get into the book. One interesting thing about Esther is that it doesn't mention God. No God, no the Lord, not even prayer. God is conspicuously absent from the entire book. And again, it's masterfully written, I think, because the author is trying to underline what God is doing behind the scenes by not even talking about him. It's very cool. Okay, so let's get into it. So the year is 483 BC, and we're in the Mede-Persian Empire. So you can imagine, like, in your mind, all of the Middle East plus a bit more, like a huge, vast empire. In the past few weeks, we saw that there were some Jews that went back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, and that's fine and great. But Jerusalem is a teeny little city in this humongous empire, and so there's Jews all over the place, and we're going to be in the city of Susa, one of the capital cities, and there's a nice little Jewish population there. And there's four characters you're going to need to pay attention to, okay? And I'm going to use playing cards to kind of help us keep on track of them. So the first one is the king, King Xerxes, all right? We had King Darius, we had King Cyrus, now we have King Xerxes. He's the king over the entire kingdom. And then we have two queens. The first one is Queen Vashti, and then the second one, the Queen of Hearts, is Queen Esther. Next, we have a joker, Haman. He's our antagonist. He's pretty self-centered and just, ugh, you just love to hate this guy. He's the joker. And then we have our ace, Mordecai. We'll learn about him and see how God uses him to flip things around. All right, so let's get into it. If you have your Bible, you can turn to Esther chapter 1, or you can follow along on the screen. It says, at that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, the nobles of the provinces were all present, and for a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When all these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. All right, that's the prologue. This guy loves to party, right? Epic, epic party. I don't know if you went to Dykeman this weekend. It was nothing. It was 180 days, a huge festival, people coming and going all over the place. He's showing off his kingdom. He's raising money for wars that he's going to have. An epic party. And if that wasn't enough, King Xerxes, he loves a party. He wants to have an after party for 7 more days at the end. And the story explicitly says that during this after party, they could drink as much wine as they wanted. So, what do you think is going to happen at the 7th day? The king and all his nobles are pretty wasted. And they call for Queen Vashti to come and wear her crown and display her beauty. Now, it doesn't say explicitly, but some people think that they wanted Vashti to come wearing nothing but her crown. And Queen Vashti apparently has more self-respect than that, so she doesn't want to go in front of these drunken men either way, so she refuses. Well, this is a big deal. The king is very offended, and he ends up deposing her as queen. She's no longer the queen. And to, you know, guard his manhood, he sends a message to everyone in the kingdom that women, you need to respect your husbands. All right, this guy's whatever. It's a different time. It's a different place, obviously. He's not a God follower. But now we have a problem. We don't have a queen for the kingdom. All right, so fast forward a few years ahead to, we're going to be on move number 2 now. All right, we meet our protagonist, Mordecai and Esther. So the story says that there's this Jew, Mordecai, who lives in Susa, in the capital city, and it turns out in his life, his cousin, he adopted her as his daughter because her parents tragically died and she was an orphan. And so Esther, his cousin, had been growing up under his parentage for her whole life. And the Bible says that Esther was very beautiful. Well, that's it turns out to be an important detail, because to find a new queen, the king's officials start a kingdom-wide campaign, almost like a weird beauty pageant of kinds, to go out into the kingdom and find all the hottest virgins in the whole kingdom, bring them all together in a harem at the capital city in Susa, and then get them all prettied up, and then they'll go meet the king, and he'll pick whichever one will be the new queen. Different time, different place. So Esther, because she's so beautiful, she's taken into the harem and goes through a full year of beauty treatments to be prepared for the king. And we learn something important about Esther, that her personality is pretty charming. It turns out that when she's in the harem, she wins the approval of the head eunuch. Again, this is a different time, different place. Talking about a harem, and then there's a eunuch in charge of it. Well, anyway, he likes her a lot. She wins him over, and so he gives her 7 extra people to help her out. He gives her the best food. He gives her the best room. And then, after this year is over, when it's Esther's turn to go meet the king for the first time, she goes to this eunuch. It's like, what should I do? And she does only exactly what he tells her to do. Apparently, it was the right thing to do. She goes to see the king. And actually, even before she goes into the king's presence, the story says that She won everyone over, and then eventually including the king. And Queen Esther is declared queen throughout the kingdom. And of course, the king throws an epic party. It's a national holiday. We have a new queen. All right. Next, in move three, we have a seemingly insignificant story about Mordecai, which will be important later. But we learn that Mordecai keeps going to visit Esther the whole time that she's in the palace, and he's just checking on her, seeing how she's doing. He's a good, you know, father to her, and she's obedient to him, and she doesn't tell anyone that she's Jewish because Mordecai has told her not to. Well, while Mordecai is at the palace, he learns about an assassination plot by two of the king's own guardsmen. So he goes to tell Queen Esther, and Queen Esther, of course, tells the king that Mordecai heard about this. And in chapter 2, verse 23, when the report was investigated and found true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. All right, moving on. Move number four. We'll see how that comes into place later. But move number four, we meet our antagonist, Haman. Now, Haman is a guy that all we know about him is that he's one of the king's officials, and he's elevated to second in command for no reason at all. He's just the second in command guy. And the only thing that we know about him is that the story says he's an Agagite, which means that he is an Amalekite, who their king used to be Agag, so they're the Agagites, but he's an Amalekite. Oh, the only reason you need to know that is because they are the ancient enemies of the Jews. So there's already, we know this guy is going to be bad. There's some animosity between him and the Jews, and we quickly learn why this guy is so bad when he has an interaction with Mordecai. Now, Haman, he's the second in command, apparently has a pretty big head about it, and he demands that everyone bow before him and show him honor whenever he enters the room. But in verse 5, it says, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, the Jews, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Dang, Mordecai, he just won't, like, you know, go all the way and bow down to this guy. And instead of, like, dealing with the guy he's got a problem with, he's like, no, I'm gonna annihilate his entire people group. Now, this is like an ancient Hitler, really. And really, I think it's just because ultimate power, or absolute power, corrupts absolutely. I mean, he's second in command. He thinks he can do anything. And Haman uses his influence with the king. And I just love how this is written in the story. He goes to the king. He says, King, a very important matter, there's a certain people in your kingdom that have strange customs and they don't follow your laws. No need to clarify that these are the Jews and to substantiate any of these claims, but they're terrible people and we must destroy them. Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe the king has already had a few drinks that day. He's, whatever, Haman, you take care of it. Here's my signet ring, which is like a symbol of you can speak for me and send out an edict to the whole kingdom and it'll be in my name. So Haman takes that and he writes an edict to kill, destroy, and annihilate all of the Jews in the entire kingdom on a certain day. And he casts the lot to pick a random day, and he picks the 13th day of the 12th month. And he has all the scribes write it down in all the languages of the entire kingdom, sends the king's couriers out to every corner of the nation to tell everyone that on this day you are able and even required to destroy, kill, annihilate all of the Jewish people. And of course, the people, when they hear about this, all the Jewish people, they wail and weep, they fast, they put on sackcloth and lay in ashes, which is an ancient practice to show that you're in mourning. And Mordecai, He's at the citadel in Susa, and he's got his sackcloth on, so he can't go in and see Esther dressed like that. But he sends her a message and tells her the whole story, all what Haman has done, and asks her, Esther, you've got to go to the king and beg for our lives. You've got to save us. Now, Esther sends back a response pretty much saying it's not really that easy. Turns out she hasn't seen the king for 30 days. So we don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Don't know how the king is feeling about her right now. And there's just this law that you can't just go to see the king. If you do, you'll be put to death. If you just push your way into the king's presence, you'll be put to death. Unless the king, he hands out his golden scepter to you and accepts you. Now, you might be thinking, what? This is ridiculous. Can't a man's wife go and see him? And like, this is a serious situation we have to deal with. But you're forgetting that this is an ancient time where women are treated like property. We've already seen how Xerxes deposed his wife Vashti for not coming when he snapped his fingers and called her to come. He could easily kill Esther and find 1,000 other gorgeous queens to have at his disposal. So this is a pretty big deal. And how Mordecai responds to Esther is kind of the central part of this story. Look at his response to her in Esther chapter 4, verse 13. He says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" So Mordecai just kind of faces the brutal facts here. He says, look, Esther, if you don't do anything, that doesn't mean you're immune to this edict. You could die too. But regardless, he speaks of God in a indirect way here. Says, regardless, I believe that deliverance will come, a.k.a. God will deliver the Jewish people some other way, even if, Esther, you decide to do nothing. But think about it. It says, who knows that you've come to your royal position for such a time as this? In other words, who knows if God has placed you providentially in this position for this time? And Esther's response in verse 15, "Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. She said, 'Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.'" So Esther decides to fast. And it's almost hard for me to not finish the phrase, like, fast and pray. Because that's what you do when you fast. When you give up food, you're saying, God, I need you more than anything else. I'm dependent on you. You pray to the Lord. And so Esther and the people, they pray for 3 days and three nights, and she decides she's gonna go to the king. Who knows what's going to happen? If I perish, I perish. All right. On to move five. Queen Esther goes to the king. She enters his presence, and he's happy to see her. He extends the golden scepter. And she comes to him, apparently knowing that God is up to something. He's spared her life. And the king asks her, "What can I do for you?" And he says, "I'll give you even up to half of my kingdom," because he understands that Esther coming to him is, she's risked her life to do this. This must be really important. And he loves her so much, says, "I'll do whatever you want." And again, Esther is very charming here, very wise. And she decides this is not really the right time to bring up my issue. I don't think this is going to be the right time. So she has a banquet. She says, "King, I'm throwing you a party. I know you love parties. Come to a party tonight, me and you, and Haman. Bring Haman along." So they have a party that night, a dinner party. Esther puts it all together. I don't know if she was planning it during the 3 days of fasting, getting this all ready. But they have this party, and the king asks her, okay, Esther, you know, what is it? What can I do for you? And again, she just doesn't feel like it's right. She waits and says, King, I'm going to throw one more party tomorrow night. Could you come over to that, you and Haman, and then I'll tell you exactly what it is I need. All right, we're almost there. On to move six. So after that, two things happen that night and that morning that are crazy. So that night, Haman leaves the party. He's our villain, and he is just on top of the world. He feels so great. He was invited to Queen Esther's party, just him and the king and the queen having a party. Pretty great, huh? Well, let's pick it up in the story. In verse 9, chapter 5, verse 9. It says, he went out that day happy and in high spirits, but when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, calling together his friends and Zeresh's wife. Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above all the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she's invited me along with the king tomorrow. I'm so wonderful. Like, can you believe this guy? I mean, he invites his friends over. Hey, guys, why don't you come on hang out so I can tell you how awesome I am? I know, I'm pretty great. Just love to hate this guy. He's awful. Well, and look at the next verse. After he's boasting about himself, but all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see the Jew Mordecai sitting in the king's gate. Boo-hoo. Well, Haman's friends are just as rotten as he is, so they suggest, Haman, you need to kill this guy right away. Don't wait for the edict to go out. Here's what you should do. You should build a 75-foot pole and impale Mordecai on it. Your Bible might say a gallows, but anyway, it's 75-foot high to kill Mordecai. And Haman's like, great idea. Do it right now. In the middle of the night, let's build it, and I'll go to the king and see if we can kill Mordecai right away. Now, here we are. It's the fulcrum of the story. Are you ready? I'm so excited. This is going to be great. This is huge. This is what everything hinges upon. And after this, things are going to zoom real quick. All right. Are you ready? Here it is. Esther, chapter 6, verse 1. That night, the king could not sleep. Yeah? Let me read it again. That night, the king could not sleep. Now you're probably thinking, Nathan, I couldn't sleep that great last night. What does that have to do with anything? Well, in this story, it changes everything. And you can't miss it because the entire organization of the story points to this. God is doing something right here. He caused the king to not be able to sleep. And we'll see why that's important down here. Move six. So the king couldn't sleep, so he asked for one of his servants to bring the history of his reign, to read, like, the minutes of his reign. Probably pretty boring, so he can, like, fall asleep. But what do you think they read about when they're going through the history but the Jew Mordecai uncovering an assassination plot to kill the king? Well, the king is awake now. Like, what? Oh, my goodness, what have we done for Mordecai? And the servant is looking through the book, like, well, we haven't given a medal of honor. We haven't done anything for him. The king is like, we got to fix this right away. Hey, is there anybody out in the palace that any of my officials we can bring in here? And who do you think is out in the palace? Haman, our joker, is out there ready to ask the king if he can impale Mordecai on his 75-foot pole. Ooh, the irony is so great. So Haman comes into the king's presence, and the king is like, Haman, now I need your help with something. There's somebody, it doesn't say who, there's somebody I want to honor. How should I honor them? I need some ideas. And Haman, the story even says, Haman thought to himself, who could the king want to honor except me? So he thinks of his dream scenario, I guess. He says, King, here's what you need to do. Get one of the king's horses that the king has ridden with the king's crest on it, and then get one of the king's robes and put it on him. One that you've worn, put that on, and then have one of your officials lead him on the horse around the city, proclaiming, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. And the king is like, you know what, Haman, I'm glad to have you around. That is a great idea. I think you should do it. You do everything you just said for Mordecai the Jew. Don't leave anything out. I want you to, you be the one who goes proclaiming before him and leading him around on the horse. And so Haman is crushed. He has to do it. He goes and gets the horse. He goes and gets the robe. He puts it on Mordecai, and then he leads him through the city proclaiming, this is what is done to the man the king delights to honor. And then he covers his head with shame, and he goes back home. But he's only got time to change his clothes, because here we are in move 5. He's got to get back to Queen Esther's second banquet. So here we are at Queen Esther's second banquet. They've had a few drinks. Haman has had quite a day. And the king asks her, hey, you know, what is your request? And Esther replies to him, my request is my life. My people have been sold to be killed, destroyed, and annihilated. The same three words that Haman used before. And she says, if we were just going to be sold to be slaves, I wouldn't have bothered your majesty, but we're going to die. And the king is furious. He said, who would do such a thing? And we pick it up in the story. Esther said, an adversary, an enemy, points to this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king, notice this, got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the garden. Yes, Haman knows exactly what's happened. Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. And so the king leaves for a few minutes, and Haman runs over to Esther. In verse 8, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining, and the king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house? As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So Haman's face is covered yet again. This time, he's going to die. And just at this time in the story, one of the king's officials pipes up, says, Oh, hey, King, you know, every time I come to the palace, you know, I pass by Haman's house. You know, I noticed he built this pole. It's 75 feet high. And, you know, I think he was going to ask you if he could impale Mordecai on it. You know Mordecai, he's the Jew that saved your life, and you just sent Haman to proclaim to everyone how great he is. Yeah, what do you think we should do about that? And the king says, impale him on it. So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. And talk about a reversal of fortunes real quick. Well, here we are, move 4, because Haman is dead, but his edict is still in power. And in the Persian Empire, you couldn't just throw away a law. It was on the books. That's just how they did things. So the king gives his signet ring, I guess he took it from Haman, he gives it to Mordecai and says, do whatever you think is best. So Mordecai writes an edict, he sends it out in all the languages, and the king's couriers send the message out to the whole kingdom telling them that on the 13th day of the 12th month, when the Jews are be destroyed, the Jews have the right to assemble and defend themselves. And once they receive the message, Jews all over the country stop fasting and start celebrating. They start feasting. Well, finally, the day comes in move 3. It's the 13th day of the 12th month, and throughout the entire nation, fear of the Jews has fallen on all the people, and fear of Mordecai. And so what happens is the Jewish people come together, and what happens in the end is instead of being destroyed, the Jews destroy their enemies throughout the entire kingdom. It says 75,000 of the Jews' enemies were destroyed in this day. And so there's great feasting and celebration, and move to Esther. She witnesses all of this, and she decrees that every year on the 13th day of the 12th month, they're going to celebrate how God saved them from Haman. When Haman cast the lot, or the Purim, and how God saved his people. The celebration of Purim, which Jews still celebrate to this day. And the story ends again with King Xerxes and the greatness of his kingdom and the greatness of Mordecai the Jew, who became second in command to the king. Wow, what a story, right? What a story. I mean, it looked so bad for the Jews up here. They were going to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. But instead of being destroyed, they destroyed their enemies. That's just amazing how God flipped things around through seeming coincidences. And really, in retrospect, as we look back, we can see the importance of this, that God was preserving his people so that a few hundred years later, the Messiah, Jesus, could come from this people, the Jewish people. So, man, thinking about this great story and all the ironic twists, the coincidences that happen, it might be easy for us to look back and think, oh, yeah, God was at work the whole time. It's so easy to see, right? It wasn't that easy for Esther and Mordecai, because remember, they were in it. They were right there. And I think how they reacted, the way that they made their decision about what they were going to do next can really help us. I think they did. There's three kind of key moves that they went through in deciding what they were going to do. Remember in chapter 4 when Mordecai sends the message to Esther, tells her about the plot, and Esther's like, I mean, I'll have to risk my life with this. If we look back there, there's three things that they do to kind of get a handle on things. The first one is they look for opportunities. Remember Mordecai said, who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Mordecai didn't say, everything happens for a reason. There's no such thing as coincidence. He didn't say, I know for a fact this is why you were born to do this thing, and if you don't do it, all the Jews are going to die. He didn't say that. He said, you might die, but God will deliver. God's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to deliver the Jews. And at the same time, he said, you know what? If you don't do anything, you're going to die. Like, he wasn't, he faced the brutal facts here. But the reason he's kind of in between, he doesn't really fit into either side, is because he was looking for God the whole time. What might God be doing? I just love how he says it. He says, who knows? Who knows? I think a lot of the times as Christians, we are a bit too quick to say, God is doing this. Oh, God is doing this and this and this. I think a better posture sometimes would be, who knows? Because if it's revealed that God is doing something, you're on board. But if it turns out, nope, God's not doing something with that, it's okay, you're not crushed. Who knows? So in your life, what decision are you having to make right now? Think about your life and the circumstances of your life. Do you need to ask, like, who knows? Is God doing something in my life? And I bet you, you know, 9 times out of 10, if you ask the question, it might turn out, yes, you're just not aware of it. Who knows? So the second thing, they look for opportunities. Second, Esther invited God into her life. Remember, she responded by fasting and praying. She spent 3 days doing this before she did anything else. She fasted and prayed. Remember, fasting is keeping away from food to communicate to God that I depend on you, I need you, I'm inviting you into my life. Or maybe you can think of it, I'm inviting myself into whatever you're doing, God. I need to know what you're doing. So is there something that you need to pray about that you have not prayed about? You've thought about it? You've You've been wondering, maybe God is doing something in my life, but you haven't really given your life over to Him and said, God, I don't know what this is, but whatever it is, I'm going to trust You. Maybe you need to fast about something. Maybe you could ask somebody in your faith family here at Everyday to fast with you for a day or a meal or a few days. They would be honored to fast with you and to seek God's face together. The last thing that Esther does is she acts in faith. She does something. She decides what to do and does it. There might be something in your life. You don't need to pray about it. You need to do it. And don't be so worried about whether it's God's will or not, because here's the deal. You're going to make the wrong decision a lot of times. You're going to do the wrong thing. You need to act in faith. Now, if I could boil all of that down to a phrase to help us remember, it would be what we've been saying the entire time we've been going through the story. Find your story in God's story. Find your story in God's story. Don't just think about your story and what's going on with your life and how you can be happy and content and whole. Don't be worrying over here. You've got to construct something to do for God. You've got to find His will all the time. You've got to be totally in sync with God. No. Quit worrying about your story so much. Find your story in God's story. Be looking for Him. What is He doing? God, I depend on You. Would You show me what to do? And I'm going to step out in faith. Maybe it'll flop. Maybe it won't work out. Maybe I've heard from You wrong. That's okay. I'm going to step out in faith, trusting in You. You see, I think this is really how Jesus lived His life, our Savior. This is how He lived His life each day in His ministry. You see, when Jesus became a man, we believe that He lost a few of the attributes of God. He was limited. He was not able to know every single detail of every single moment of every single day. He lived like you and I, walking one step at a time to whatever the future held. But we see Jesus the entire time. He's always looking. Where is God at work? What is God doing? In John chapter 5, He said, talking about Himself, He said, "The Son can do nothing by Himself. He can only do what He sees His Father doing." See, Jesus wasn't trying to manufacture something that he could do for God or try and figure out what God was doing. He's just looking. What is God already doing? And how can I be a part of that? Jesus was, Luke chapter 5, verse 16 says that He often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Even Jesus, we were talking about Jesus, He knew that it was extremely important for Him to spend time alone with the Father, in a relationship with Him, talking to Him about what's going on in His life, asking Him, inviting Him into His life every time. And then finally, Jesus was ready to act. Matthew 14:14 says, just this one time, Jesus was out. It says, "The crowds came unexpectedly, and Jesus, even though He was exhausted, had compassion on them and healed their sick." Healed their sick. God did a miracle through Him that He was not planning on that day. But He was looking. He was in relationship with God. He was ready to act. We've got to find our story, not in our lives, not in our story, but in God's story. I mean, what would it be like? What would it look like for us when we face difficult decisions, when we look at the circumstances of our lives? What would it look like for a community of people that think differently than the world? Because we're always looking, what might God be doing through this? We're not trying to guilt people, trying to say, oh, God is doing this specific thing, but we're just open. Who knows? Who knows what God might do? A people that are so dependent on God, not themselves to figure it all out. They're dependent on God. I need You to show me what You're doing. I invite You into my life. A people that's ready to act. When God provides something that they weren't expecting, they're ready to act, to decide. They're not waiting to wait for a sign, to wait for a miracle. they're ready to act. I think Jesus said it best himself in Matthew chapter 16. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will find it. Let's pray. Father, I pray that you would help us to do this. God, would you help us to be looking for how you're involved in our lives? God, if we need faith in that area, would you give us faith? God, would you help us to seek you? God, convict us when we haven't prayed about something we need to be praying about. Would you convict us? Would you remind us? We need help. We're not perfect. Help us to pray, to seek you. God, I pray that you would help us to act, to not be petrified by fear and guilt and shame about whether we make the right or wrong decisions, but God, help us to act in faith, trusting in you. God, I just pray that you would empower our church to live in the way of Jesus. Amen.